From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On Tuesday, Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta arrived in a silver Lincoln Navigator SUV at a Los Angeles gas station to talk up his proposal for the first change in U.S. auto emission standards in 30 years.
The cost of filling up is hitting many family budgets very hard. That is why I'm here today to announce a new plan that will improve gas mileage for over half of the vehicles sold in America and save drivers as much as 10 billion gallons of gas.
Cars and light trucks, SUVs, account for a whopping 40% of all U.S. oil consumption. Now, oil is getting very expensive and increasingly hard to come by. And after binging on cheap oil for more than a decade, the U.S. has an automotive industry tooled to turn out monster vehicles. The Bush administration says it's pointing the way out of the bind. Environmentalists and some observers of Detroit competitiveness call the new standards a joke. This hour on Point, as the Hummers roll on, new auto emission standards and what they mean for the environment and the future of the American auto industry. You can join the conversation. Do you see a breakthrough here or more Hummers? Will the market, oil prices, force Americans into cleaner vehicles? Will SUV-happy U.S. automakers be around to build them? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Chicago is Danny Hakem, Detroit Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Danny, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So explain to us what's going on here.
Well, you know, obviously the current fuel economy regulations are a pretty complicated system. Basically, three decades ago, after, you know, the energy shocks of the early 70s, a regulatory system was created, and it divided each automaker's annual production into two categories, cars and light trucks.
Mm-hmm.
And each category had a mileage requirement. So, say, all of Ford's cars, you know, today have to average 27.5 miles per gallon.
The fleet average.
The fleet average, that's right. And all of its light trucks, which includes SUVs, pickup trucks, and minivans, have to average 21.2 miles per gallon. Now, I mean, one of the problems with that system over the years has been the industry saw, well, you know, light trucks have a much easier standard, so instead of making cars, we're just going to start making light trucks.
And that had a big impact. We see the Environmental Protection Agency, President Bush's own, finding that since the late 80s, we've actually, if you look at it as an American fleet, it's become less efficient significantly.
Right, right. I mean, and the reason for that is automakers are making heavier vehicles. They're making more SUVs. Instead of making, say, station wagons or car-like vehicles, they're making more SUVs. They're making large pickups.
So what's being proposed?
Also making vehicles that are faster too.
Performance oriented rather than efficiency oriented.
Right.
So what's being proposed here? Is this to get the country back on track with higher mileage or something else?
Well, obviously it depends who you ask. What this would do is it would take this single mileage average for light trucks and break it up into six categories depending on, and they're determined by the dimensions of a vehicle. And each of these six categories would have a separate fuel economy target.
So the smaller SUVs would be required to have higher fuel economy. Hummers, the big H2, 8,500 pounds plus, required to have or no limits.
Well, and one point of contention here is that the largest SUVs and pickup trucks today are not regulated. And under this proposal, they will continue not to be regulated. So, you know, a Hummer H2, for instance, it has no fuel economy regulations. When you go to buy one, there's not even a sticker on the window because it falls outside of the fuel economy regulatory system.
If you have to ask, you can't afford the emissions. How does this all intersect with U.S. automotive industry's competitiveness, with Detroit's competitiveness, Danny? Is this being designed really to cut down on emissions or to help Detroit out of the bind it's in? We see yesterday GM and Ford both, their credit rating cut to junk bond status. They're burning through cash, $3 billion already this year. GM losing money hand over fist. Is this intended to help them out of their competitiveness problem?
Well, yes and no. Yes, it is intended to do that. But, you know, some people think maybe it won't do that. I mean, you know, General Motors and Ford both, their production is pretty heavily dependent on large SUVs and large pickup trucks, and those have really driven their profits, you know, in the late 90s, in the last few years. Mm-hmm. But as gas prices have been rising, we've really seen some weakness in those vehicles. And, you know, all these employee discounts we've been hearing about have really been driven by the weakness in those large vehicles because so much of their production is dependent on those vehicles. Now, the Bush administration says this new plan is really designed the system is designed to be easier for GM and Ford because, you know, under the current system, the least fuel-efficient vehicles have to be balanced against more fuel-efficient vehicles because
right.
it's an average.
Mm-hmm.
So if you break it up into more categories, then, you know, it's easier for a company that is really dependent on the least fuel-efficient vehicles. It's easier for them to get by.
So in a way, it's SUVs unbound here. What about the bigger competitive picture? The Japanese have made big inroads with the hybrid situation. Is the U.S., addiction to those big cars and big light trucks become a competitive millstone around its neck looking forward?
Well, I mean, one problem in the auto industry is that it's really hard to quickly change directions. I mean, it takes years to develop cars and trucks. So, you know, if you've really sort of bet the farm on large vehicles, you can't just, you know, when gas prices start to rise, you can't just snap your fingers and change direction. Now, both GM and Ford have sort of redoubled efforts to develop smaller, more fuel-efficient SUVs. They're called crossovers in Detroit. And, you know, I think over the next few years we'll start to see some of those come out. But right now, Honda and Toyota and Nissan, to some extent, you know, really sort of dominate that segment.
Do you think ultimately, Danny, that it won't be emission regulations but the price of oil that will push Americans toward more efficient automobiles, vehicles?
Well, I a lot of people think that really could sort of trump regulation at this point, potentially. I mean, it depends, it depends how high gas prices get and how long they stay there. But certainly, you know, executives of Ford have said, you know, in recent months that, you know, a few years ago, nobody really was thinking about gas prices when they were shopping for a car.
Mm.
And now it's, you know, it's definitely a top five, top ten consideration. It's something that's, you know, that it's a major concern for buyers. So that's certainly something that even Ford is very aware of right now.
So they're selling a third of what they're selling now is SUVs and pickup trucks. One wonders if they'll be there to pick up on that market if and when Americans turn. Danny Hakim with the New York Times, the bureau chief there in Detroit, joining us this hour from Chicago. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
I want to turn now to Washington. We're joined there by David Friedman. He's research director for the Clean Vehicles Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. David Friedman, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
So we saw Norman Mineta standing there at the almost $3 a gallon gas station in L.A. near the airport, his big silver Lincoln Navigator, a symbol of American automotive production, at his side, saying, we're going to save $10 billion or 10 billion gallons of fuel with this program. This is going to make everybody happier and save Americans money. Is he right?
Well, the claim or the statement of saving 10 billion gallons reminds me of an Austin Powers movie where you're trying to make it sound like it's a big deal, but it's not. The reality is 10 billion gallons, first, that amount of fuel isn't going to be saved for another 15, 20 years. So
it will be over that amount of time, yeah.
Exactly. It'll be 15 to 20 years over which we will save that amount. To put it in perspective, 10 billion gallons is about the amount of gasoline we use in 25 days.
So we're going to save 25 days
over
worth of
nearly
gas.
20 years.
Okay, not exactly the ocean.
It's not going to help consumers at the pump, and that's the sad reality about the changes that the Bush administration has made. They're trying to portray this as a way to relieve pain at the pump, but the reality is consumers better buckle up because high gas prices look like they're here to stay and the administration isn't helping.
We're going to look at a lot of angles on this, but what's your bottom line analysis of what is being done then with these new emission standards? What's the purpose of them?
Well, the purpose of them appears to be in part to make it a little bit easier for some car companies to meet the regulations. My fear is that it's actually going to make it a lot easier for some of the car companies, and that's going to actually make them less competitive. Part of the problem in the marketplace right now is companies like Toyota, Honda, and even Nissan have been really good throughout the decades at bringing products to market to help meet consumer demands and to help meet things like high oil prices and gas restrictions. Look back in the 1970s. Part of the whole reason why the Japanese auto industry is so powerful in the United States today is because they were ready with the technology to deal with the gas hikes in the 70s and 80s. If we back off on asking the big three in Detroit, GM, Daimler Chrysler, and Ford, from doing more, we're going to weaken their ability to respond to continued high gas prices.
Could it be that they're in such desperate straits that they can't look longer term than this, that they need this help right now to get through the next 4 or 5 years? They're sitting on $20 billion at GM, but they're using up at this rate $3 billion a year. When that runs out, no one knows what's going to happen. Maybe this is an emergency bailout plan.
Well, the problem is if you treat a spoiled child the same way all the time, they're going to stay a spoiled child. They're not going to improve on themselves. Part of what you've got to do with Ford and GM is ask them to step up, ask them to innovate. There's a lot of really talented engineers at those companies. They've got the technologies that they can use to improve the fuel economy dramatically of every car, truck, and SUV they sell. It's a question of getting them to put that technology to work.
David Friedman, we've got to take a short break here. If you could stand by there in Washington, we're going to come right back and hear a lot more. We are talking this hour about controversial new emission standards for SUVs, for American vehicles, and America's global automotive competitiveness in trouble. David Friedman with the Union of Concerned Scientists has joined us. We'll have more voices in just a couple of minutes here. You can join us as well. When you think of fuel efficiency, do you think Detroit or Japan? When you think the future of the American auto industry or the automotive industry, do you think America or elsewhere? And do these new emission standards sound like a breakthrough or like enabling the SUV parade to go on? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about controversial new emissions standards for SUVs, light trucks, and America's global automotive competitiveness in trouble. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Does Washington need to clamp down on emissions, or will the market take care of that all by itself with those oil prices we see out there? Why isn't Detroit a leader in fuel-efficient automotive production? Why not? And did Detroit win the SUV battle with these new standards and lose, potentially, the automotive war? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined this hour by David Friedman, Research Director for the Clean Vehicles Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, with us from Washington. And now with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, Daniel Roos, Professor of Engineering Systems at MIT. He's founding director of the International Motor Vehicle Program, a research program that examined motor vehicle industry practices and products from an international perspective. He's author of The Machine That Changed the World. Daniel Roos, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
So Norman Mineta, Transportation Secretary, steps up. He and others are saying we're going to these changes would result in a 15.9% improvement in light truck fuel economy from 2004 to 2011. That doesn't sound like nothing. Is it a worthy standard that's being proposed here?
As both of your previous guests have indicated, this is modest at best. It certainly is going to improve fuel efficiency somewhat, but overall it will not have a very major impact. CAFE standards were imposed 30 years ago when we have an average fuel efficiency of 13.5 miles per gallon. And over a period of not too many years, we doubled that to 25 miles per gallon. And since then, very, very little has been done. There have been several studies by the National Academy. Fairly aggressive fuel standards have been suggested in the reports that have come out. And so this is certainly modest in comparison.
So here we are, oil hitting a record $68 today. GM and Ford having their credit rating cut to junk bond status. If the United States doubled its overall fuel efficiency in a few years after the implementation of emission standards, why not do that again? Technically, could it be done? In business terms, could it be done, Daniel Roos?
We're not necessarily suggesting doubling. There's a certain amount of catch-up baseball here since nothing has happened over the past several years. and the internal combustion engine and technology have improved. Now, the improvements have gone into performance. Some or all of those improvements could have gone into fuel efficiency. The last National Academy study suggested that 33 miles per gallon was certainly attainable and has been pointed out before. The increases proposed are only for light trucks. They're not for cars. I think it's also worth noting that when these standards were first put in, trucks were really used as trucks.
Right.
And that's why they were a much lower standard of 21.2. And now these vehicles, by and large, are not being used for their off-road characteristics. They're being used much more for passenger transportation. And so a lot of people will question why there ought to be such a dramatic difference between the two standards.
David Friedman, how about it? Why aren't we seeing higher emission standards for passenger cars here? I mean, if a third of what Americans buy are SUVs and pickup trucks, it's a big number, but that leaves two-thirds automobiles. Why not raise those standards as well?
Well, that's a really great point. The reality is that looking at technologies in the National Academy of Sciences, looking at high-strength materials that the National Academy didn't even look at, the administration could have easily, just for the truck standard, doubled, if not tripled, the increase that they looked for, and they could have applied a similar amount to cars and trucks across the board. We could be saving, instead of waiting 20 years to save 10 billion gallons, in 2015 alone we could save at least 10 billion gallons of gasoline if the administration had really taken a more science-based approach and made sure that the auto industry put the technology to work.
But what's your interpretation of why that's not happening? I mean, for a long time, we didn't hear anything about raising emission standards. Now we've got some hikes proposed, but cars left out of it. What are the politics or the economic considerations? What's driving this sort of move to keep that off the board?
Well, I think what's driving it is status quo. The auto industry does a great job squeezing every penny they can out of investments they've made over the last 10 to 20 years. They're in business to make money. That's what they do. But the problem is, as they squeeze the pennies out of what they've done over the past 20 years, those pennies come out of yours and my pocket in the form of high gas prices. So part of this is an attempt to basically keep automakers where they are so that they don't have to make new investments. New investments do cost more money up front. But just like if you're investing in a new home, if you're investing in your child's college fund, it pays off in the long run. And that's the lesson that we really need for the U.S. automakers to take to heart. This isn't about planning for 2 days, 2 weeks, 2 months ahead. It's about planning for 5, 10 years down the line.
And hoping those automakers are still around when that point comes. And there seems to be some question. We've got a lot of callers who want to join us. I want to begin. Daniel Ruse, yes, please.
Yeah, I just want to comment on that. When you look at this issue, you have to look at it from two points of view. The old regs are controlled by the Department of Transportation. DOT has the ability from year to year to increase them. So over the past several years, they could have increased it without any kind of congressional approval.
But they've never done that, if I've got it correct.
Well, they did it in the beginning, mm-hmm. and they've done it modestly. But, you know, clearly this is an administration that has not put its emphasis on conservation. The second approach is the congressional approach. And there have been a number of bills that have been introduced over the past several years, some of them quite aggressive. All of them have been turned down.
Turned down by Congress.
That's correct.
So you've got politics speaking up loudly there, and that because what? They think Americans want those bigger cars, or because they've got Detroit plants in their backyard and don't want to ruffle them?
Well, there's some of each. But by the way, I think there's an important point that hasn't come out here that should, and that is that there now are two car industries in the United States. We certainly have the big three. Mm-hmm. In Detroit, but on the other hand, you have not only the Japanese, you have Europeans, and now you have the Koreans, all of whom have built plants in the U.S. These are all employing U.S. workers. Now, they're very different in regard to the big three in two respects. First, they're non-union, whereas all the big three is unionized. Mm. And secondly, they're located throughout the South and the Southwest.
Not Detroit.
Not Detroit. And so what we're seeing is as market share is going down from Detroit, plants are being closed in Detroit. On the other hand, new plants are being built. Hyundai just opened up a $1 billion plant in Alabama. So this is a dynamically changing industry.
And yet, Americans still put a lot of stock in having their own U.S. automotive manufacturers who are healthy, providing jobs, and are American. I see some speculation that this new proposal might, in fact, permit lift barriers to shifting production from the U.S. to smaller trucks to low-wage economies like Thailand. That doesn't sound like building up Detroit, but I want to get to our callers, if I may. David's calling from Boston. David, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to make the point that I think the American public and the American-owned car industry both deserve to be in the bind that they're in. The public, because we've shown a preference for larger cars, and that's in part driven the industry's direction. And the American-owned car industry deserves to be suffering because they haven't responded to an obvious need for more efficient cars. I just got back from a trip from France where most of the cars you see are much smaller and much more efficient than the American cars, and it's disgusting when you come back and see the size of our cars and hear people complaining about the price they're paying at the pump because we chose our big cars.
So, David, do you think that Washington should push all this in a new direction, or do you think the market will, that oil prices will?
Well, I've always thought that the government should take a bigger role. I think, I think Jimmy Carter was somebody who saw the future and tried to act and was really hurt politically for that. I've always felt our government should be more proactive, and as an advanced industrialized country, we should take the lead in showing other countries, you know, what can be done with the resources that we've had. But I think it will come down to high prices, you know, finally scaring customers and finally getting our public to think about buying more efficient cars, whether that be American cars or foreign cars. And I think at this point, the foreign car companies have a lead, and they deserve to have the lead.
David, we've got it, and let us take that observation straight to the source here. Thanks for calling us. We are joined now from Washington by Christopher Preuss. He's a spokesman for General Motors Corporation. Mr. Preuss, thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
You hear our caller chiming in there and saying, hey, the American auto industry, not to mention consumers, but the American auto industry deserves the bind that it's in because it sort of made its own nest here. What do you say to that?
Well, he made some really interesting points. First, his point about what consumers are choosing.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, his observations having gotten back from Europe. Taking the latter, in Europe, General Motors sells a wide variety of cars through Opel and Saab, and now most recently launching the Chevrolet and Cadillac brands there. And we sell a vastly different lineup of cars in that market than we do in the U.S.
Because of government regulation or because of what European consumers want?
Because the government of those nations, predominantly across Europe, have adopted a pretty robust form of taxation on fuel, taxation and incentives around displacement on engines, and have driven the market in a direction that has kept it more fuel efficient.
So if the U.S. government, let's just imagine, it won't happen, but imagine it laid down the same kind of scheme over what was required of cars in the United States. Could GM respond? Could you put all those European cars on American highways over the next 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, look, we predominantly want to be in business to sell consumers the vehicles that they want. I think it should be pointed out to the observation that you have two industries developing here in the U.S. relative mm-hmm. to cars. That's very true. And if you look at where most of the capacity in the U.S. is going from transplants, it's going to trucks. Toyota's building a $1.5 billion truck plant down in San Antonio to do just that. I mean, they're seeing the market in this regional sense, and that's where they're capitalizing the business to take advantage of that, and they'll pump in lower-cost, small products that carry less price from other parts of the globe.
So they're in the United States building light trucks, too, because there's demand for that here. But let me ask you, Christopher Preuss, are you worried? Is GM concerned? I mean, we're looking here, credit at GM and Ford cut the junk bond status today, $3 billion already eaten up so far this year from cash reserves at GM. Are you worried that the U.S. auto industry is getting so far out on the SUV limb that as oil prices go up and consumers want those more efficient cars, you won't be able to deliver, you won't be able maybe to survive?
Well, clearly energy prices in two ways, one in vehicle choice and what portfolio you're offering, and secondarily just the overall drag on the economy are both very serious concerns for us. I would point out, though, that you know we do sell a full lineup of cars here and have choices for consumers across the board. The difficulty for us is that you know we offer 20 vehicles that get 30 miles per gallon or better. We have launched and are launching a whole new family of passenger cars at various levels of the market. As we speak, we've got new, more efficient, smaller crossover SUV and minivan platforms launching and coming. We've got a diverse portfolio. The difficulty for the big three is that the fixed cost base is so high based on the history of our legacy.
You're paying health care costs for all your retirees, that overhang?
That's right, $5.6 billion of health care cost and a couple billion more that we pay into pensions every year. Against, you know, transplant competition that, frankly, doesn't carry that burden. That equates, depending on how you do the accounting, anywhere from $1,500 to $3,000 or $4,000 a vehicle, depending on what price point the market is.
And that's a lot of money. David Friedman, how about it? Christopher Pruse represents GM, and he says, look, we've got 20 vehicles at 30 miles a gallon or better. We do the right thing in Europe. We're trying to do the right thing here, but this is what American consumers want, and we've got all these costs we're saddled with. We can't help it. We're doing the best we can.
Well, it's great when automakers bring out the choice argument, and especially the 20 vehicles that get 30 miles per gallon or more, but you've got to realize primarily those vehicles are compact cars, maybe a few family cars. What if you're a mother of three, all three of those kids need to be in a car seat? You need a minivan. The problem is automakers aren't offering real choice in the showrooms in terms of giving them a minivan that gets 30 miles per gallon, 35 miles per gallon, which the National Academy of Sciences says that they can do. So if you walk into
David,
a dealership, you don't have a lot of choice because you're really restricted in what fuel economy you choose. What the auto industry is telling consumers is, if you want fuel economy, go drive a compact. That's not fair to that mother who needs to carry around those kids. As relating to the legacy costs, there's no doubt that there are some additional costs that the auto industry has, but a lot of that, again, is linked to the attitude of the big three to just plan for 2 days, 2 weeks, 2 months from now instead of 5 or 10 years from now.
Christopher Pruse,
long-range planning, they could deal with a lot of
Christopher
that.
Christopher Pruse, how about it? Are you fiendishly withholding high-mileage minivans from America's mothers?
What's so disappointing is that at this day and age that we're still at this level of discussion with the advocacy community over what the dynamics of the business are. First off, the statement that we should be offering 35-mile-per-gallon minivans. Nobody in the industry has exceeded any one category in fuel economy across the board using conventional technologies. If you look at our minivans compared to Toyota's or Honda's minivans, our full-size cars compared to theirs, our full-size trucks, we, model for model, are many times leading them, if not competing directly with them, on the fuel economy. The issue of choice and what consumers want, I think the European argument is very relevant here. Price of gas will do far more to reshaping the vehicle fleet and the offerings that customers will choose than any government regulation or fiat move from regulators.
But when it does, are you going to be there at GM to take advantage of that, or are you going to be history because you've got lots full of SUVs and factories to build them?
Well, as I pointed out, we don't have just lots full of SUVs. We do have a diverse lineup of vehicles that we can meet that with. Secondly, we will announce today in Detroit that we've finalized our agreement with Daimler Chrysler on providing a family of hybrid technology that's going to be deployed across a variety of vehicles starting in 2007, and we will be able to compete with advanced technologies. We've made a $1 billion investment in fuel cells, and we'll be making news here in the short term about what are just continuing breakthroughs that we've been able to make on the cost equation for hydrogen as a long-term solution. And we're deploying a whole host of technologies such as six-speed transmission, cylinder deactivation, advanced electronics, big movements in aerodynamics, rolling resistance, and all the things that we need to do to get the efficiency of the current model line as competitive as we can.
So don't count GM out just yet, and yet we see that junk bond status trying to make sense of all this. Christopher Preuss, spokesman for General Motors Corporation, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We are talking about controversial new emission standards for SUVs and American global automotive competitiveness. You can join us. Could the U.S. end up losing both the environment and the automotive industry? Do you see GM coming back, surging forward into the high oil price future? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about new emissions standards proposed by the Bush administration for SUVs and light trucks, and really talking more broadly about the future competitiveness of the U.S. auto industry. GM and Ford, their credit rating cut to junk bond status yesterday. What do you think? When you think fuel efficiency, do you think Detroit or Japan? And will high gas prices somehow, weirdly, ultimately, save the day? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hello. I just wanted to, you know, there's a lot of talk about what consumers want to do and what the American consumer is doing. And I just want to give you my story as someone who wanted to keep his car. I owned a Volvo 940.
Okay.
And my wife would carpool the kids to school and take four kids. And recently, they passed laws. We didn't have a front airbag, but they recently passed laws that all kids had to be in the back seat. So my choice was either stop carpooling or buy a bigger car.
So what do you take away from that, John? Do you want government intervention to keep emissions down, or do you want the market to rule, government stay out of it? How do you see it?
Well, I think the government needs to realize that some of the regulations they pass have a dramatic impact on car design. And when they first came out with a passenger airbag, Volvo refused to do it. They said it would kill children, and they were right, and they're still right. But, you know, now you have to have a much bigger car than you used to 10 years ago.
So it's sending you off in search of a bigger car, even as oil prices, gas prices rise. John, thanks for calling in from Nashville. Daniel Ruse, how about it? This brings up the subject of safety. The Bush administration is saying that they're taking safety into account when they're publishing this new emissions proposal, that they don't want Americans left in smaller, unsafe cars. Is that a good rationale for what's being proposed here?
Yes and no. If you look at the social impacts of automobiles, there's a whole range of them. We not only have energy utilization, we have urban air pollution, we have global warming, we have the recycling of the materials that are in the vehicle, and of course we have safety. And there's a trade-off. For example, if you want a more fuel-efficient car, typically you will have a smaller car and a lighter weight car. You might, for example, go to aluminum or you might go to plastics.
But are those unsafe in their own right, or because the road is crowded with 8,200-pound, monster cars?
Well, it's a combination of both. The smaller cars, by and large, are not as safe as large cars, although one can design a small car to be reasonably safe. On the other hand, if you have, for example, a car that's built of these lightweight materials, it's going to be far more difficult to recycle that vehicle. And so if you go to Europe, where recycling is important, you're going to run into some regulations different from the U.S. And these are international products that are sold around the world. So
because they use more sophisticated materials, you're saying you can't just throw them in the steel scrap heap.
Exactly. So what you've got to do is you've got to balance the safety standards, the fuel economy standards, and the recycling and the environmental standards, and that's very, very tough to do. But, you know, I want to go back to your comment about government role, and let's talk about Europe for a moment, and your caller who mentioned that he was in France.
Right.
In Europe, 40% of all cars are diesel. In France, 70% of all cars are diesel. In the U.S., almost no cars are diesel, and that is a result of government regulation. Now, there are some issues with respect to diesel with regard to NOx and particulates, but diesel can buy you easily 20 to 30% improvement in fuel efficiency, and several studies in the U.S. have suggested very strongly that we and the government ought to be focusing much more on diesel technology.
Why haven't we? Because it smells bad?
Well, there are these environmental concerns, I think, that to a large extent have held back, and it is to a large extent that it smells bad. The public perception, we had a very poor introduction of diesel vehicles. Another point that I wanted to make, we keep talking about consumer choice, and there's not only consumer choice of autos, but there's consumer choice of how we use autos or alternative to autos.
Maybe there's choice. Some people don't have a choice. They live where there's really nothing to be done but climb into a car, truck.
Well, to a large extent, that's true given the lifestyle that we have in the U.S., but as the previous caller mentioned, you do have things like carpooling, which can be done no matter where you're living. Although it's sort of interesting, carpooling has gone down as a result of two-wage earners who typically cannot commit themselves to the same schedule each day.
Right. Life gets complicated. And meanwhile, we see, high as gas prices have become, they're projecting higher travel over Labor Day weekend this summer than last. So it's not as though it's crimping American style too much.
But getting back to your other point, telecommuting, which can be done out of a rural environment, is increasing dramatically. You're adding probably over 1 million telecommuters a year, which is cutting down on the work trip. Car sharing, Zipcar, now has taken off in several areas of the East, and it's moving into the West.
Rent the car for an hour or a day, yep.
That's right. Mm. And Zipcar has done a number of surveys which shows that the people who subscribe have gotten rid of cars, have not bought cars. There is an increase in mass transit. So there are a variety of these other options that are available to consumers that we shouldn't forget about.
So a lot of ways to skin the cat, but we're still left looking at this overall fuel efficiency rating for the American fleet writ large, and it's not getting better. We're told by the EPA it's getting worse. Judith is calling from Clinton, Massachusetts. Hi, Judith. You're on the air.
Hi. I bought a Prius a year ago, and I traded in a Jeep Grand Cherokee, which I love dearly, but I'm a teacher, and I have an hour and 10-minute commute.
Okay.
And could not possibly, with the projections that I put on paper, afford to keep that car and spend, you know, $450 to $500 a month. That's just not something I could afford. So
for gasoline, and you must be feeling pretty good today, given what's happened with gas. You've got a car that's much better. How's it going?
Totally. Love it. I get about 60 miles to the gallon. When I'm in bumper-to-bumper traffic, it goes on to the battery, so I don't have to deal with pollution. I'm not polluting. It makes me feel good. I have asthma, so I don't get the fumes coming up under the car. It's about a thousand. The person that was just talking, I'm sorry, I don't know who he is.
That's Daniel Ruse from MIT. Mm.
Okay, I'm sorry. My car is 1,000 pounds heavier than a normal car because of the battery. So this winter, out where I live outside the Beltway in Boston,
yeah.
I slide in on ice most mornings because I can't come in at my leisure as a teacher. I have to be there. So I have front-wheel drive. The car held the road as beautifully as my Jeep Grand Cherokee. I was shocked to find out. I was scared to death that I was going to be in very dangerous, you know, commute every morning.
But it sounds like you're feeling great about it. You've gone to that Toyota Prius to the hybrid. So what do you think, Judith? Should the government be pushing people toward that kind of decision, or should it wait, as in your case, for the market to push them there?
I think I think everybody should be pushing us in that direction. What's the point of polluting? I mean, what's the luxury in polluting? I don't get it.
So you can drive a living room around, but we've got it, and we're glad you're liking your drive there, Judith. Thanks for calling, David Friedman. Do you see Americans flipping over to a different kind of car? I mean, we didn't always drive SUVs. Maybe that's a fad. Maybe a decade from now we'll look back and think maybe less than that. Wow, how crazy was that? And we're all in little cars now.
Well, it may be part fad, but it is really part government regulation being broken in having the different standards between cars and what they called non-passenger vehicles at the time, but which the SUVs and minivans today, which are actually have the lower standard, are technically called trucks, even though they really carry around people. So
even
part
when you're
of
down to the PT
today,
Cruiser and the Toyota RAV4, they don't look like trucks, but that's what they're called.
And the Dodge Magnum, it's a station wagon,
yeah.
Subaru
right.
Outback station right. wagons, but they get to be called trucks. So a lot of it has had to do with loopholes in the regulation. And look, the auto industry has proved that it's really innovative at taking advantage of every single one of those loopholes when they can. They're really great at meeting the letter of the regulations, but beating the spirit. And that's part of what's led us here today. You heard what the auto industry said, and their solutions to high gas prices are A, telling consumers to go buy compacts, and B, telling consumers that we need high gas taxes like they have in Europe. We need to be clear, gasoline in Europe is nearly twice what it is today. Yes, would that enable people, would that push people into maybe smaller vehicles or higher fuel economy vehicles? I'm sure that's true, but that's a really painful way to do it.
But our GM spokesman was also saying we're making announcements today about new hybrid vehicles. We've got fuel cell technology on the way. He's painting GM as a budding leader.
GM is great at making announcements and poor at making progress. That's the reality. We did a ranking of the environmental performance of the six major automakers. When we first did it in 1998, General Motors was in fourth place. The last time we did it for the 2004 year, GM had fallen to last place. So they're great at making announcements. They're pretty poor at making progress. But they don't have to be that way. There's a lot of smart engineers there. If they would innovate and put the technology to work, we could see the progress. We wouldn't have to be talking about stuffing the people who need to protect safety and put the kids in the back seat. We wouldn't have to talk about stuffing them into smaller vehicles. We could be talking about putting them into minivans and SUVs to get dramatically higher fuel economy.
That's
the reality.
Let's hear from the drivers out there. Andre's calling from Winnsboro, South Carolina. Hi, Andre. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, my comment was that about General Motors and Ford. My generation, I'm 37 years old, and my
okay.
generation always bought the older cars, Buick and Chrysler and all that. But I do see that everybody my age is starting to switch to foreign cars. And I'm getting ready to switch after I get through paying my car off to a smaller car, which is going to be foreign because they're better. I don't see General Motors as going up anytime soon. I see them as going down. I mean, all their cars are bigger, use more gas. I don't see gas prices ever going down again. They don't ride as good, so we're headed downward. That's just my opinion on it.
Andre, why do you think GM is not making the products that you'll want to buy and drive? Why? Why not? They've got great engineers there, as David Friedman says. Why don't you think they produce?
I don't know what's going on with them. I mean, I don't see why they haven't, after all these years, looked at the foreign competition and took some note from what they do. I mean, let's say they're not as reliable, but it's about the gas, too. I mean, they can make smaller cars that get better gas mileage that last longer, and I don't know why they haven't picked up on that. They did good with the Chevrolet Prism when they made that back in the, 90s, and then some kind of way they stopped it because Toyota was helping them on that. And then I don't know what their problem is. They're just not catching on. I mean, my generation, 37 years
yeah,
on and
yeah.
upwards, and, you know, they are starting to switch. I'm
going right overseas, and we can see that all over the highways. Andre, thanks very much for your call. I want to get another caller in here, if I may, from Arlington, Massachusetts. Rachel is on the air, on the line. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, how are you?
We're good. What do you think? What do you know?
Well, I am responding. Unfortunately, the representative from GM is no longer with you, but when he talked about how GM is affected because of unionization and how they have higher costs, that's very
right.
true.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also tooth and nail suing the state of California because they have had legislation to decrease greenhouse gases,
right,
which would indirectly mean that CAFE standards would have to improve for vehicles mainly produced by Detroit. I also think it's kind of sad that the greatest nation in the world, as far as innovation goes, really lags behind as far as hybrid technology. And Ford, which has the first SUV that's a hybrid, mm-hmm, had to purchase their technology from Japanese companies.
Yeah. Makes you wonder about the future, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And they always say that, you know, they make up some excuse for why what they produce really is not of the same caliber of foreign manufacturers. But in reality, they just don't think more than 2 years down the road.
And we drive what they build, or we don't. We go overseas. David Friedman, what about this issue of state regulations? I understand this new proposal Norman Mineta is laying out would actually push states away from effectively creating their own emission standards. Is that right?
Well, buried on page 150 of this proposal is a statement by the administration that states cannot regulate global warming pollution. First, they don't get to say that in this proposal. That's not the way it works. The courts have to decide that based on what's existing law. The president.
But it is in there, you're saying. You're saying they can, but
it's in there. Right. It's in there, and it's basically the administration putting their stamp down, saying that they support the lawsuits that the automakers are doing to try to stop California from helping to improve public health by improving the air, by reducing the amount of global warming pollution that's going up there.
Do you think that will stand? Will they get away with that?
Well, I think California has a great case. They've been allowed to regulate air pollution for the past 40 years because they were the first ones to start it. And their regulations on air pollution have affected fuel economy at the time, but it's been realized that we've got to protect public health and that the automakers have the technology to both protect public health and deal with global warming pollution and deal with fuel economy at the same time.
And Daniel Ruse, finally to you. We've just got a couple of minutes here. We're hearing this sort of conflicting views of the future this morning, but we see financiers voting with their feet, with their ratings on GM and Ford. You've looked at technology and business practices all around the world. Do you see GM, Ford, the big three in the U.S., pulling this out? Do you think they're going to get ahead of this curve or get swept under by it?
Probably the most important factor here is, can these companies turn out exciting cars? And the answer to that is yes. If you look now at Chrysler, the Chrysler 300 is a big hit. Ford has the Mustang, which is a big hit. GM has been able to turn Cadillac around. So selectively, one can see in each one of these companies the ability to produce product that's appealing to the public. The problem that GM has had is people don't like their cars. People haven't bought their cars. So it's not just a question of fuel efficiency.
So you're saying still with oil where it is, it's sex appeal, not efficiency.
Well, it's a combination of both. And clearly efficiency now is going to play a more important role, but there's no reason you can't have attractive, exciting cars that are also fuel efficient.
Well, there's the big challenge as the billions drain away, and we wish them good luck with it. Daniel Ruse, professor of engineering systems at MIT, founding director of the International Motor Vehicle Program, thank you very much for joining us. And David Friedman, research director for the Clean Vehicles Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, joining us this hour from Washington. David, thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jupp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.